I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. After a mass shooting, speculation about the killer's mental health often crops up in media coverage. Sometimes it's an alternative to efforts aimed at reducing the number of guns. Today, we'll ask a leading researcher and psychiatrist to take a hard look at whether mental illness is really to blame. Have we made those with depression or other disorders a scapegoat? What are the implications of such a narrow focus for gun policy in America? But first, a look at cross-dressing at a time and in a place you might not expect, the American frontier. We'll take a look at the long history of drag right here in Kansas City. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Perhaps our images of men and women in the old American West tend toward the stereotypical, tough sheriff deputies and rough-hewn cowboys for the men, women dressed for the bordello or the burlesque, or perhaps reduced to Little House on the Prairie floor-length dresses. But there's another set of images that should be part of our picture of the frontier from more than a century ago. Cross-dressing, men dressed as women, women as men, sometimes for entertainment, but often, more often than history has generally explored, for the bulk of their lives. Joining us to talk about this history is Stuart Hines, Associate Dean of UMKC Libraries, also curator of the Gay and Lesbian Archive of Mid-America. Stuart, welcome back.
Thank you.
And also Peter Bogue. He's professor and Columbia Chair of the History of the American West at Washington State University. He joins us by Skype this morning from, I think, from Pullman, Washington. Hello, Peter.
Good morning.
Welcome. Thanks for being with us. Peter, in fact, you've written a whole book about this, Redressing America's Frontier Past. How is this not a better known part of American history?
Well, that is a very long story, but it has to do with the development of the frontier myth, the Old West myth, at the same time that modern concepts of homosexuality developed. And as homosexuality developed as a concept, it was something that was removed from conditions that are associated with the frontier, such as wilderness and hard work and specific gender identities for farmers and women who made the homestead household.
And what is the time period we're talking about here?
This would be in the late 19th, early 20th century, especially intense around the 1880s and 1890s.
Now, how did you come to identify this set of facts about this period in American history?
Well, it was kind of by accident. I was working on an earlier book, and as I was working on that book, I hadn't discovered it deals with gay male identity in turn of the 20th century Portland, Oregon. And while I did that research, I didn't discover a great deal about lesbianism, but it had to do with the types of sources that were available to me, mostly legal documents. And women were pretty much excluded from the public world at that time, so they didn't often end up in legal documents. However, when I found a few stories about women dressing as men in newspapers. But after I finished that book, whole new technologies became available to do research, digitalize newspapers that made it easier to do searches over a huge area in lots of newspapers covering many years where I could find these types of people. And they were in enormous abundance in those sources.
So tell us about one of them. Give us an example of someone who you discovered in your research.
Yeah, well, if there are some better known people who are known, but one person that I was completely unaware of till I found newspaper sources on him was an individual known as Sammy Williams, who died in Montana just after the turn of the 20th century. But Sammy Williams had the body of a female, which was discovered at the point that Sammy Williams passed away and his body was being prepared for burial. And that's typically, well, that's one of the ways in which many of these people were exposed in history is when they died, they were discovered to have bodies that didn't match with how they comported themselves in daily life. So Sammy Williams is an excellent example of somebody I discovered in the newspapers.
I want to come back to that and ask how you think that connects with sort of present day conceptions about gender identity and transgender identity. But let me come over here to Stuart Hines. Stuart, Kansas City was not necessarily the cutting edge of the frontier during this time period, but still an outpost of the West. Are there records of this phenomenon happening in Kansas City as well?
Absolutely. The first indication we see is in the revised ordinances of 1860. There is an ordinance that states whoever shall in this city be found in any dress not belonging to his or her sex shall be deemed guilty of a misdemeanor, which tells us right off the bat that city leaders felt it enough of an issue to codify prohibition of this kind of behavior.
And what is the issue that they seem to have with it?
That's anyone's guess. It's transgressive. It crosses boundaries. What I have found to be interesting as I have explored this topic is this contrast between the acceptability of performative cross-dressing and the unacceptability of cross-dressing on the street.
So by performative, you're talking about what today we might call a drag show, people just dressing up as the person of a different gender, not because they identify that way, but because they want to pretend.
Exactly. And we see first evidence of that in the 1830s in minstrel shows and throughout the 19th century in minstrel and variety shows until the advent of vaudeville in 1880. And simultaneously, at least in Kansas City, of course, with an ordinance that people can violate, then they get arrested. And that's where we find the accounts in local newspapers is typically when someone gets arrested.
But that's not for performing. It's for
being on the street.
Trying to pass.
Right.
Let me ask you, Peter, how much of this was performative in the American West and how much of it was people actually trying to live their lives looking different?
Well, that's also kind of a difficult question to answer because we don't know how many there were. So we only know those who came to our attention. And as Stuart mentioned, they usually came to our attention when they were arrested or, as I mentioned earlier, newspaper articles that revealed them at the time of their death. Certainly there were large numbers of men in the West who dressed as women in blackface minstrelsy or vaudeville, as Stuart mentions, or other types of theater productions. But it's also true, as Stuart mentions, that large numbers of these men, or at least the ones I discovered, also carried on in women's clothing and of female gender identity when they were off the stage. But there are also any number of people, and this is especially true of women who dressed as men, not all of them, but many who performed in the role of a male in order to get better employment, in order to live a safer life in the American West, in order to actually do sex work. That was one of the indications that a woman was available as a prostitute was when she dressed as a male.
Well, that seems very, very counterintuitive.
It does, doesn't it?
Were there cases of men dressing as women in a similar sort of practical way, or would there not have been any benefit or advantage to men to dress as women in that particular cultural context?
Yeah, well, that's then the whole issue that helped me question the typical, the old-fashioned story about why women dressed as men is they did it for practical reasons. But I began to question that as I discovered more and more men who dressed as women for apparently no practical reason at all. Now, of course, I did discover, in fact, that there were practical reasons. So this was a job for some to perform on stage as women. But then they crossed the line. Many of them actually did identify as women offstage. But then I did find an occasional story that men sometimes dressed as women in order to carry off a crime as a sort of a disguise, in a sense. Some did it for, there was one character, I think he was in Iowa, who dressed in women's clothing because of the health benefits, because of the restrictive nature of men's clothing.
Stuart Hines, where in Kansas City would a person have experienced this phenomenon? Were there particular centers or locations or theater venues where this cross-dressing took place most?
Well, cross-dressing on the street really takes place primarily in the downtown area. There were theaters. By the time vaudeville comes around, there were circuit theaters, basically chain theaters. The Schubert, the Orpheum, both had outlets here in Kansas City, and those two are the primary venues where we see performative drag of about the 135 female impersonators over the course of vaudeville, 1880 to 1930. There's evidence of about 35 coming to Kansas City. During the same period, there's about 15 nationally known male impersonators who perform in vaudeville. And of those, there's evidence of about 3 who come to Kansas City.
But it was one of the stops.
Right.
Let me check some of my own assumptions with both of you. Were the expectations of people based on their gender as clear-cut as I have portrayed it, as sometimes we think of the American West? Were men all expected to be burly and muscular and gruff? Or have we imposed that from too many bad Westerns?
I think it's a combination. I think there is that traditional narrative of the hypermasculine cowboy and the demure prairie lady. But what's very interesting about Dr. Bogue's book is that he really talks about how it's not that way. There's all this other stuff going on that, as he alluded to, because of the discomfort in regard to that particular kind of behavior, gets erased from the narrative.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison. That's Stuart Hines from the UMKC Libraries. We're also talking with Peter Bogue from Washington State University about the phenomenon of cross-dressing on the American frontier a century ago. Peter Bogue, is there a moment of cultural turning when this became less acceptable in either a performative or a sort of dressing on the street sort of way?
Well, as far as performance goes, especially when you come to vaudeville and for men, female impersonation on the stage, it's a process that happens over time. But in the early 20th century, and historian Sharon Ullman has written an excellent book on this topic, that as homosexuality becomes increasingly identified as a sexuality, it's created along with heterosexuality at the turn of the 20th century, but as homosexuality becomes better understood as an identity and it is associated with gender inversion, meaning people who dress as women, men who dress as women are considered homosexuals, women who dress as men are considered lesbians. As this happens increasingly in the early 20th century, it becomes more difficult for onstage performers, and a very good example of this nationally known Julian Elting, it becomes increasingly difficult for them actually to continue on as female impersonators. So that actually declines as a type of theater work.
It's interesting that in today's context, in a context where diversity of sexual orientations have come to be more broadly accepted in culture, and transgender people are often feel like they're the ones who are seen as more transgressive, as facing more challenges in acceptance in society.
Yes, but you know, what was curious to me is that I often found in a number of cases of people who lived the lives of somebody who was understood at that time to be the opposite sex, there are any number of cases where I found that these people were known in their communities in the West, and they were well integrated into those communities. They might have been perceived as a little odd, but they were accepted as part of daily life. An excellent example of that is Joe Monahan, who lived in southeastern Idaho during from the 1870s up until his death around the year 1900.
And what happened with Joe?
Well, Joe had the body of a female and appeared in southwestern Idaho during a silver and gold rush in 1870s. And was known in that community as somebody who had a female body but dressed as a male. In fact, one of the interesting historical documents that I came upon, I think it was the 1880 census. In the 1880 census, people's sexes, of course, are enumerated, and Joe Monahan is listed there as male, but in parentheses, a person indicated the person who was taking the census, who happened to be a neighbor of Joe Monahan's, explained that the sex was highly doubtful. They actually wrote that into the census.
Wow.
And then when Monahan passed away, I think just right after the 1900, there were some lengthy newspaper articles in which locals were quoted extensively who explained that, you know, we knew for a long time, or we surmised for a long time that Joe actually was a woman, but we always accepted Joe as a man. And even after death, when Joe was understood to have the body of a female, these locals persisted in referring to Joe using masculine pronouns.
Well, and I was going to ask about the pronouns, because obviously in our contemporary present day understanding, transgender people, certainly not everyone agrees on this, but most major news organizations, for example, will use the pronoun of a person's choice, their own identity. That assumes a modern understanding of gender identity. How much was that in fact understood? Would people have understood Joe Monahan, who identified as male, to be male? I ask both of you, but go ahead, Peter.
Well, that also is a little difficult to answer. We only have the documents to go by, and it is clear that when Monahan passed away, people knew for sure that he had the body of a female. But as I mentioned, many of them continued to use the masculine pronoun for him.
Stuart, are there local examples in the records of people who seem to have been broadly understood to be what we would call transgender?
There are a couple of folks who are identified as living for a number of years as the opposite gender. But interestingly enough, your question about pronouns, they almost all of the accounts refer to the pronoun for the biological sex of the individual.
Regardless of how they dressed.
Right, mm-hmm. Right, regardless of how they presented.
I mean, as you look at that history, Stuart, especially here in Kansas City, do you feel like today's transgender people or those who simply perform, drag queens, drag kings, are they the descendants of these cross-dressers of a century ago?
Well, I think particularly the performative drag queens are. But what I really appreciated about Dr. Bode's book was the way that he was very careful in his use of pronouns. And in dealing with today's more complex trans community, I've always been told that if you have a question about a person's pronoun or any aspect of their gender identity, just ask them. And that leads me to think that it's incumbent upon today's trans community to either work with historians or take the effort to write down or save their own stories so that future historians don't run into the issues that Dr. Bogue and myself have run into in terms of trying to get at who amongst this population really were trans and who were presenting for other reasons.
Let me ask you, Stuart, did Kansas City have any sort of unique elements? You mentioned that these theatrical performers, for example, stopped here, but they stopped in lots of other cities as mm-hmm. well. There was something of a community here of people who did cross-dress. But was there something about Kansas City that uniquely positioned it to be a place where this occurred, or was it just another American city?
I think it's just another example of a medium-sized city on the frontier west in which this activity occurred. The specific examples that are unique to Kansas City are the more performative kinds of drag. For example, in the Priest of Palace Harvest Festival, which ran from the mid-1880s to 1920, a series of week-long parades. In the primary parade, the main float featured Pallas Athena, who was always a man. So the primary social event on the calendar in Kansas City featured a drag queen on the main float.
Peter Bogue, I'm struck by the way today's debates about transgender people serving in the military or so-called bathroom bills, that a lot of them reflect society pushing back on something that maybe doesn't feel familiar. Do you think there are lessons or parallels to be drawn with what you have learned about how society addressed these issues a century ago?
Well, yeah, there are certainly parallels. I mean, we would find, for example, cross-dressers who served in the military and cross-dressers who used the facilities of people that didn't perhaps match their biological sex. But I think it was as varied 120 years ago as it is today. Some people met with tremendous acceptance in their communities. Others were reviled and driven out and jailed and held in contempt. I'm a historian who studies change, but one thing I've learned about change is that people don't seem to change a great deal over time.
You're also a historian who studies matters of race. I'm curious if there if this is something that affected a diverse set of racial or ethnic groups in America.
Well, I certainly discovered the cross-dressing phenomenon in all the races that there were in the American West, and it was the most racially diverse part of the United States. And but I also, one of the chapters in my book deals with the ways in which homosexuality and femininity were increasingly associated with racial minority males in the late 19th and early 20th century as this white frontier mythology of the masculine male is created.
So say more about that. That you're saying that there is a greater connection of so-called of stereotypes of masculinity for people of color in that period?
Yeah. So the stereotypes of males who are racial and ethnic backgrounds that weren't white, they are increasingly identified with effeminacy and sexual deviancy as the frontier myth is created. So the frontier is associated increasingly with masculine white males, whereas those who are left out of the story are those who are increasingly understood to be deviant racially and as far as their gender goes. Yeah.
Stuart Hines, before we let you go, you obviously curate the Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America. Are there resources here that people who want to dig more deeply into some of these issues can access?
There are resources. There's one collection in particular, the James Tharp collection, which is nothing but these newspaper accounts of cross-dressing in Kansas City, primarily in the late 19th century.
All right. That's Stuart Hines. He's Associate Dean of the UMKC Library. He's also Curator of the Gay and Lesbian Archive of Mid-America. Stuart, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Peter Bogue from Washington State University. He joined us by Skype from Pullman, Washington. He wrote, among other things, Redressing America's Frontier Past. Dr. Bogue, thanks so much.
You are welcome.
When we come back, we'll examine with a leading researcher the alleged connection between gun violence and mental health. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On yesterday's Up to Date, we learned about a youth program in Kansas City, Kansas, and a domestic violence court in Kansas City, Missouri, both of which are working to break cycles of violence in the metro. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and also on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, our Children's Health series looks at tummy troubles. With one of the biggest eating days of the year happening this week, parents will want to tune in for this, so join us tomorrow on Up to Date. It happens almost after every mass shooting incident, and we've had plenty of them recently. There's a call for thoughts and prayers. Then there are calls for regulations on gun ownership and perhaps restrictions on certain weapons. And finally, there are responses and arguments. And often, these arguments ask America to focus not on guns, but on mental health, suggesting that shootings like the one in Las Vegas or the one in Sutherland Springs, Texas, or the one in, well, wherever, that they'd all be less likely to have happened if only our mental health care in this country were better or our gun laws focused on the mentally ill. So is that true? We're exploring that question today with Jonathan Metzl. He's professor and director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. He's joining us today from NPR in New York. Dr. Metzl, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad you're here. And I do want to try to make the case as strongly as it can be made. I want to play a clip from this program about 6 weeks ago. It was 2 days after the Las Vegas shooting. Phil Journey is a Kansas District Court judge and a former state senator. He's also a longtime NRA member and official. And he was talking with our host, Steve Kraske, about his understanding of the causes of gun violence. Here's what he said.
Well, I think that when you look at past incidents that we have complete information about. I mean, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, Killeen, Texas, San Ysidro, California, San Bernardino, California. They're all mental health related incidents, individuals that are clearly, easy to say after the incident, a danger to themselves or others. In almost all of those incidents, there were warning signs. There were issues that were looked at by mental health professionals. And the reality is, of course, that in the last 30 years, government has essentially gutted the mental health system across the country.
Jonathan Metzl, you're a psychiatrist. You've studied and written about this. Do you agree?
I absolutely do not agree. Let me say, first of all, that I understand why people turn to questions of mental illness and mental health in the aftermath of mass shootings. Mass shootings are very traumatic. We're searching for some kind of answer as to why a citizen would kill other innocent people. And often there are mental health histories of particular mass shooters. And certainly that is one of many factors that helps explain why somebody would commit an act like this. But I think the automatic assumption in the clip you just made and in endless kinds of similar clips, President Trump right after the Texas shooting, for example, without any evidence whatsoever, immediately blamed this on a mental health issue, and I think it's problematic really on a number of levels. One is that there's an assumption when people say it's mental illness, the assumption is this is a problem of somebody's individual mind or their individual brain. It's not a problem of anything else, culture, society, gun laws, regulations, many other factors. And the assumption is basically mental health causes somebody to act in a particular way, and we don't need to look at anything else. So partially, I think that narrative engenders a kind of helplessness about other kinds of causes. And the other issue is it's unbelievably stigmatizing, this assumption that basically people with mental illness are ticking time bombs, who are off, you know, likely to go off and commit a mass shooting at any point, is a complete inversion of really the statistics about gun violence in this country. If you look at gun violence writ large, we have about 38,000 gun deaths a year in this country. And people with mental illness across the spectrum of gun violence, first of all, are far less likely to commit shootings. They're less likely than sane people to shoot somebody else. And the other factor is that they're often victims of violence if you look at everyday gun violence. And so for these reasons, I think that this stereotype is really it just gets us off the track of what we all want, which is talking about safety.
Sure. But I mean, a lot of stereotypes are rooted in some fact, or maybe it's a fact that has been twisted in some way. It does seem, does it not, that a lot of these mass shootings involve somebody who we later find out has a history of mental illness.
Well, the clip you played, for example, as I understand it, was after the Las Vegas shooting.
It was just after.
And so let's take the Las Vegas shooting, for example. You know, for example, here's somebody who's in their 60s, who has gone through life, has been a relatively successful businessman, who has had, you know, marriages and relationships, maybe come to a kind of warning sign about some kind of psychiatric symptoms. But there were many, many other factors, getting bump stocks, accumulating an arsenal, all these other factors. And so in a way, Las Vegas is, I think, a perfect example here where certainly there were mental symptoms. But the assumption that goes from that is let's not look at anything else. And I really think that's where we get into problems. And I think Las Vegas, Texas, all these factors. I'm not saying that there aren't psychological issues. I think that that's clearly the case. What I'm saying is the assumption that therefore that's what caused the shooting, that's where we really get into problems for multiple reasons.
I want to invite our listeners to the conversation. What do you think about this connection that is sometimes made between mental health and gun violence? And what do you propose we do about it? Give us your ideas by calling 816-235-2888. You can address your questions to Dr. Jonathan Metzl, who is joining us. 816-235-2888. Do we know, Jonathan, where this idea first came from, when this concept entered public discourse that somehow undiagnosed or untreated mental health disorders were behind gun violence?
Well, certainly there are age-old stigmatizations of people with mental illness as being ticking time bombs, and that goes back, obviously, for centuries. And again, high-profile mass shootings with often imbalanced, mentally imbalanced people is kind of where we talk about gun violence in this country. So we don't really talk about everyday gun violence in the ways that we do kind of mass shootings. And so certainly in the aftermath, as the clip before talked about, of some of these high-profile shootings like Virginia Tech and other factors like that, certainly there's a mix of the history of the stigma and the characteristics of particular mass shooters that I think, you know, engenders this particular stereotype. But if you think about it, think about the leading mental illnesses, for example. Schizophrenia is a diagnosis that's thrown around. Well, it turns out people with schizophrenia are very often either psychologically disorganized or they have what are called negative symptoms. They stay home. They don't engage in the public sphere very often. Depression is another main psychiatric diagnosis. People who are depressed have what are called neurovegetative signs. They, again, have low energy, low mood, and they're less likely to commit shootings. And so if you look at the main mental illnesses, there really isn't a mental illness whose symptoms include attacking other people, let alone shooting other people. And for that reason, we see people with mental illness underrepresented in national data about shooting other people. And so in a way, this stereotype is an inversion of what's really happening.
Well, and you're making a couple of points about the caution that may be necessary when we generalize. So mental illness or mental health issues encompasses a pretty wide range of psychological conditions, but also just the term gun violence is a pretty broad term too, mass shootings being only one of the examples of places where gun violence happens, and in fact not nearly the most common.
Right. I mean, mass shootings are tragic. They're spectacular. They're terrorizing. You know, innocent people watching movies, kids going to school, people enjoying a concert. So it's understandable why that's when we talk about this. But across the swath of American gun death and injury, certainly a lot about gun suicide, homicide, accidental shootings, partner shootings, factors like that. And if you look at American gun death writ large, not just in mass shootings, there are a bunch of factors that are more indicative, more red flags about gun violence than is mass shootings.
Like what? Give us a couple examples real quick.
Well, if alcohol or drugs are present and there are guns and an altercation, the risk that will end in a shooting is about 5 to 7 times higher. A past history of violence is very important. If somebody's committed a violent act in the past, they're more likely to do so in the future. And that's important because of domestic violence. Often we see domestic disputes where guns are involved and fatally. Lack of gun training, I think, is very important in a number of police shootings, for example. And so there are a number of factors. Another one is, believe it or not, social networks. People are not likely statistically to get shot by random strangers, even though that's the narrative that comes out in mass shootings. It's much more likely your neighbor, your cousin, your ex-boyfriend, something like that. And so in a way, the stereotypes that we assume after mass shootings are, again, directly at odds with, I think, much more predictable patterns of gun violence in the United States. And if we want to address those, we really need to address the everyday root causes of gun violence in this country.
So I guess the question is, if you're able to rattle off this list of alternative causes of gun violence, which you say are more demonstrably true, that can be really much more closely connected with gun violence, why does this argument about mental health, about mental illness, have such traction? Why mm-hmm. does that always come up so quickly and so frequently in response to not even just mass shootings, but even more local ones?
Well, again, as I said before, on one hand, it's understandable, right? In other words, we want to think of ourselves and you know, to be honest, this kind of pro or anti-gun, pro anti-Second Amendment debate, like, you know, I find this exhausting, and I think many people do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not like there's a pro or anti-safety or death. We're all trying to find ways right now to come together to make a more, you know, a safer society where we're not surrounded by this level of spectacular and everyday violence, which is what we have now. Now, that being said, I think we do a great disservice. I'll give you one example. Right after the horrific Texas shooting in the church, President Trump, who was in Asia at the time, within less than 12 hours said, this isn't a gun problem, it's a mental health problem. And so in a way, furthering this narrative, really before there was any evidence whatsoever about the motivations of the shooter, the history of the shooter. And so part of the issue here is, I think this becomes a canard for not talking about for not having a real conversation. And certainly that's something that we've seen, for example, the head of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, and other people saying that, you know, we don't need a gun registry, we need a mental illness registry. And Coulter once said, guns don't kill people, the mentally ill do. So certainly there's a political agenda as part of this, derailing our conversation about mental illness. And the other factor is, you know, again, as I say, I think that it's part of our mode of processing. So I think it's many factors that are coming together.
It's a way of shifting the conversation to something that feels less personal, less.
And it's not about policy. Now, again, you know, we're reaching our own level of cultural insanity in a particular way. I mean, after, you know, I guess I'm not trying to sound overly frustrated, but I think the issue is when the question are, you know, bump stocks and semi-automatic weapons that fire like automatic weapons and factors like that, and we can't come together for those conversations. I guess the point I'm trying to make is I find this mental illness issue, on one hand, an important part of the conversation, but when it's the only thing we focus on, it can be incredibly frustrating and leads us from having real conversations with each other about how to respect gun rights on one hand and promote public safety on the other.
Let's take a call from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome. This is Michael. Welcome to Up to Date.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm listening to the speaker, and forgive me, I lost his name.
Well, you're talking to Dr. Jonathan Metzl from Vanderbilt University. Go ahead, Michael.
All right. Thank you very much. The point I wanted to make is I was a hands-on father, and so oftentimes I'd watch cartoons. Now, I noticed in one of the cartoons here recently, there's two characters in the cartoon, a male and a female, and the female wants to go and see a girly movie. Well, the boy doesn't want to go because he says it's not enough bang or boom in it. And when we're talking about the issue with gun violence and the fact that everybody's pushing the Second Amendment rights and all this, I see a lot of scapegoating, and I agree with the speaker that we're just trying to blame it on mental health people, and we take out the factor of all the money that's made, and also most of the mass shootings are committed by one cultural background. And so the scapegoating is not to take any responsibility for what's going on. Easy to blame people who have mental illnesses, but
Michael,
I've been around people like that before.
Sure. Michael, you've raised a number of points there. Let me ask our guest to try to address those. Differences in how boys and girls receive messages and maybe how they come to be treated?
Well, certainly if we look again at these spectacular mass shootings, another risk factor that we didn't talk about before was this question of masculinity. And very often for these form of mass shootings, it's often white masculinity. And so there are people who study this now who talk about a form of kind of toxic masculinity is what the term is in social science. It's a kind of frustration that, guns become this way of solving really deep level gender problems that have to do with privilege and power. And certainly, if you look at some of the statements that some high profile mass shooters have made, that certainly masculinity has certainly played a part. If I'm thinking about like the Isla Vista shooting, for example, and some of the other statements. So certainly that is a very important factor. And at the same time, again, I would just say that the question is what are we going to do next about this, right? And so in a way, as terrible as mass shootings are, in a terrible year, we have 400, 500 people die in mass shootings. Now, the definition of a mass shooting is four or more often strangers killed, and most mass shootings don't even make it onto the news because they're not spectacular enough, or they're happening in urban areas where it's kind of racialized violence and things like that. And so I think the problem is it's not like we're going to stop people from mental illness or from who are men and things like that from getting guns. It's really, again, I guess, the point is how can we talk about these in a productive way?
Well, I mean, I guess part of what I wonder, though, is, is it really bad to at least spend a little of time focusing on mental health care? If that could reduce gun violence even a little, wouldn't that be a good thing? Is there some way that we are missing an opportunity here to have some impact, at least in some cases?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a psychiatrist, and I think we should invest more in mental health care. I absolutely think that that's true. And I think that we have fallen short in many ways in this country, and it's inescapable that many of the same politicians right now who are saying that this is a mental health problem are not investing in the mental health system, or as the case with one of President Trump's first actions as president, making it easier for people with very severe mental illness to get guns. And so in that respect, I do think it's important to have a conversation about mental illness and mental health. Again, I don't mean to keep saying the same thing, but the problem is there's no predictive value in somebody's mental health diagnosis. In other words, you can't put everybody with depression or schizophrenia in a room and have a psychiatrist pick out which one of those people is going to commit a mass shooting or a gun crime.
Sure.
And so in that respect, I think mass shootings are moments of reckoning, and I think we need to ask bigger psychological questions than just the diagnosis of the shooter. We need to ask, why do we feel so unsafe around each other in the first place? Why do we feel like we have a society where we need guns? There's been a shift in this country, for example. People used to get guns for hunting, and now they have guns overwhelmingly for protection. So why do we feel so unsafe around each other? There are psychological questions.
Yeah.
We just don't address them when we just look at the mental health history of this one shooter.
So, Dr. Metzl, as you look at the possible solutions that are out there then, I hear you saying that this focus on mental health has allowed us to not focus on other policy solutions. From your studies, what's one solution that you would encourage policymakers to turn toward sooner the better?
Well, I'll answer that in two parts, if you don't mind. And the first part is I just think that, in a way, there's so much polarizing rhetoric out there that I do think now there's a call, there's such a vacancy right now for a centrist conversation. I spend a lot of my professional life interviewing people who are for gun control and also ardent gun owners, and most people feel like they respect gun rights, but they want our society to be safer. So I do think there's an opening for a broader conversation right now between people who are in the center, who are just tired of the extremity on both sides. So partially, I think it's
just to have a conversation.
I think we should wrestle some of this away from. I mean, obviously these are policy issues, but I think there's a center ground.
Here's someone who wants to have a conversation. Let's talk to Rick in Independence.
Sure,
Rick. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen.
What are you thinking about, Rick? Go ahead.
A little background information about myself.
Okay, we don't have a huge amount of time, Rick, just so you get, wanted you to get to your point as fast as you can.
Okay, 3 decades ago, I worked with State Senator Ed Quick. We did some investigation of child abuse at a local psychiatric hospital, and the Justice Department eventually did close that hospital down. So I've taken an interest in this very subject. And I've made some observations, and I can I don't have facts and details, but
why don't you share one observation with us, Rick? We gotta let you go.
Well, I can say three real quick. There's Columbine, there's Aurora, and the Newtown. All three of these shooters were receiving psychiatric treatment at the time they committed the horrible murders.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's let our guest respond to that observation. He makes a point.
Well, again, I am not in any way disagreeing with the fact that many high-profile mass shooters have psychiatric histories. Some were on psychotropic medications, and some weren't. And so certainly you would think there would be a warning sign in those systems. Now, I think that what we do on the level of public health is not to say we want psychiatrists to try to pick out which one of their thousands of depressed patients are going to go on to commit a mass shooting. It's to say what's the broad system in which mental health is one of a number of triggers. And I think, in a way, getting back to the last question about what to do about it, that's the idea behind, for example, the background check system, where mental health history is one of many factors in addition to past history of violence and other factors like that. And so one clear way we could address this is to nationalize the background check system and close the gun show loopholes, because I think that in a way it seems like a helpful middle ground. In other words, it's not impinging on anybody's Second Amendment right. It's also – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
Well, no. And so I think factors like that, there's also something called a gun violence restraining order, GVRO, and that's for family members who feel like a member of their family is amassing an arsenal and acting erratically. They can also say, can we take away the guns for a while? So again, I think there are middle ground positions out there, and many of them are on the books already. It just really takes enforcing them that on one hand respect gun rights and on the other hand try to make this kind of blanket issue where mental illness is just one of many factors that we address.
One really quick call left for us here. Judy in Kansas City. Hi, Judy.
Hi there, and good morning, Dr. Metzl. I agree with everything you have been saying about mental health and all the other contributors. I want to point out the importance of gun safety and the need for people who have a right to have a gun to store it properly so that nobody who shouldn't be able to get to that gun can. Gun locks, gun safe, and so that's what I think.
Thank you so much, Judy. Appreciate the call. I assume you agree with that, Dr. Metzl.
No, absolutely. Again, my main critique here is that this mental illness narrative is often a kind of coded way of saying we can't do anything about it. And it turns out even in our society where we have a Second Amendment and people are divided on this issue, there are many things we can do that respect gun rights and also make life safer. And certainly safe gun storage is among those positions that I think we should address.
That's Dr. Jonathan Metzl. He's professor and director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. He joined us this morning from New York. Dr. Metzl, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much. It's really been an honor.
You can listen back to this program and to all of our podcasts at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can also find us on Twitter at @KCURUpToDate. I'm at @PTSBrian. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Join us tomorrow on the program, Just in Time for Thanksgiving. Our children's health series looks at common causes of and treatments for stomach aches. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.